Ça me donne un grand plaisir de vous présenter deux experts. On les a écoutés la semaine dernière, un sujet très important, très adapté.
Very timely, very important discussion on the artificial intelligence. The two experts, Castel et Castel, Monsieur Jean-Gabriel, who is the legal expert, as well as Matthew Gabriel, who also is the expert and led different parts of the discussion last week. I'm going to let them take off where you left off last week, plus a brief intro, and we welcome you to Glendon. This is part of the Glendon School of Public and International Affairs with all Glendon colleagues, and I like to underline my colleague who's here from the Director of course, International Studies. Thank you for coming. It's part of our outreach to the community to share knowledge, up-to-date knowledge. Of course, we have the master's program. We have students from all over the world. It's an international program, and we are very proud to say that our students are prepared to join, Glendon students join the public sector, the international organizations. And these issues, of course, are very important to our student community. And I'd like to thank you for really taking the time and presenting this to the wider community. À vous.
Well, yeah, we appreciate that. Thank you for the introduction and welcome everybody to our talk today. As was stated, my name is Matthew Castel. This is my father here, John Gabriel, and welcome to our second installment. So I just want to, I mean, as we saw, there's a few people that are new today. I want to just sort of recap a little bit what we chatted about last time, and then that way we can sort of have a better way to get into the new material today. So we're really going to be continuing to answer the following question. So how have and how will emerging technologies affect the way people live, work, communicate with one another? So today, what we're going to be sort of looking at is really sort of the technologies and industries of the future and really how to foster lifelong learning. So last week, we really had a look at the increasingly unstable world that we find ourselves within. So economic inequality, societal polarization, and the intensification of environmental dangers are really sort of being exacerbated by the fact that society is not keeping pace with technological change. And we also looked at the World Economic Forum's findings that of the 12 emerging technologies that were studied, artificial intelligence and robotics have the greatest potential benefits, but also the greatest potential negative effects, and thus the greatest potential need for better governance. So I just want to also draw some attention to this that we sort of chatted about last week. So last week we considered some developments in robotics and artificial intelligence, and we consider the ways in which both blue and white collar jobs are at risk of being redundant. So what we found was it actually isn't entire occupations that are at risk of becoming redundant. It's really more thought about, or it's more useful to think about it as, you know, in terms of the skills and the actual technical feasibility of the actual role. So a good way to think about it is if you are sort of wondering whether your job is at risk of potential automation, it's good to sort of think of it in terms of how the particular activity is, you know, very predictable, non-cognitive, and very sort of routine. And so as you go along that spectrum, you actually see that the more sort of cognitive and non-predictable the activity is, the less at risk of automation that activity actually is. So over here, you actually see non-routine cognitive work, employment is actually increasing, whereas, as I mentioned, the routine cognitive, routine manual are all sort of flatlined. So we also last week looked at, we sort of put things in perspective. I mean, we've really been here before. The question of whether, you know, machines and new technology will take jobs away from us is really a question that has been posed really since the 1940s. So this quote here was actually taken from a discussion that Theodore Roosevelt was actually having at the time, Franklin D. Roosevelt was having at the time with a well-known sort of industrialist, and this was really the debate that they were having, right? So this is something that we've been talking about all throughout human history. And so what we found, you know, last class was really, it appears that how to deal with machines displacing human labor is really, it lies in lifetime learning and adaptability to ensure that the benefits of technology are spread as equally as possible. So that really brings us to our today's lecture. So when education fails to keep pace with technology, the result is inequality. So without the skills to stay useful as innovations arrive, workers suffer. And if enough of them fall behind, then society can actually start to fall apart. So we learned this sort of maxim really during the Industrial Revolution. So that was the first time that we sort of realized that machines were going to displace humans. And so the result was we sort of put in place state-funded vocational training to put people to work in the new sort of industrial setting. Then during the onset of automation in factories and offices, so this was sort of 80s and 90s, we realized that we needed more college grads, so we really sort of put a focus on that. So today, robotics and artificial intelligence really call for another education revolution. And this time, more so than any time, this is really needed, just because this kind of change that we're facing is of a far greater magnitude. So I wanted to put this to you guys, and I don't know, for those of you who weren't here last time, I asked a lot of questions. I want to get you guys as involved as possible so we can sort of play with the ideas and whatnot. So why do you think that this time artificial intelligence and robotics really present even more of a pressing need for an educational revolution than perhaps during the Industrial Revolution or perhaps during the early onset of automation? What do you guys think? Any ideas? Yep. Okay, machine learning. Yep. So why do you think machine learning is something that is maybe different and more alarming than, let's say, some of the machines that were created during the Industrial Revolution? What do you think?
Well, the early machines were brute force.
Brute force?
And that quickly has displaced blue collar.
Right. Okay.
Certainly in Canada, my generation, the baby boomers.
Right.
We filled these halls, right? And higher ed was the dream of all of us, and we, many by and large, chased them.
Right.
Got there. Now we're finding that there's technological capability of replacing some of the stuff that some of us might have learned to do back in the
day. I see. So even with the new education that we've gotten, the new sort of innovations are displacing that, right? Is that kind of what you're saying? Okay, right.
It is possible that that's where we're heading.
Right. Okay, so all good, interesting points. So another real, one of the real sort of reasons why it's more imperative today is really that the sheer pace of change is so much faster and more immediate than at any sort of those other phases where we realized that we needed an education revolution. Right, and also we're dealing with a world where lifetimes have extended to a massive degree. I mean, the average lifespan in Canada is 82 years, right? And we're actually more, perhaps. So in that kind of a world where lifespans are increasing and change is becoming that much more rapid, you know, you're seeing people that are retiring never. You're seeing people that are working, you know, for much longer periods of time. And therefore, cramming more education in at the beginning of one's career is no longer going to cut it, right? This is why lifetime learning for all really must be a priority. So it's easy to say that people need to keep learning throughout their careers, but the practicalities are really daunting. So what we're going to do today is really kind of dig into this and focus on how the concept of lifelong learning can and is being put into practice at present.
Can I throw a question?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd be interested in your dad's view. In terms of the pace of technological change, yes, it feels rapid this decade versus last decade versus
right.
the decade before. But if we go back to perhaps when he was my age or younger, your
yeah,
age,
absolutely.
And looks at, you know, the decade after that and the decade after that, was there a sense of it was technological change was just getting out of hand back then?
Yeah, that's a good point. So what do you think? He's asking you. Yeah, he's saying no. He wanted to get your perspective.
I want the voice of
experience. No, because I think that's actually a good point, right? So, you know, the point that I'm trying to make from what I've observed and from the research that I've done is that, you know, we really sort of need to address and improve our education and how we go about fostering lifelong learning, because change is happening at a much more rapid pace. And what he was asking was, is that an experience that you had when technological change was sort of affecting you when you were in the workforce?
Well, considering that I was in academic life, I was always learning new things
right.
all throughout my life. So,
but the pace of technological change, you must have seen it around.
Yes, I had one of the first computer. I remember a huge machine, which cost a mint too. And I've used it. In fact, I have written extensively on medical development and the law, and everything that I predicted in 1973 or 60 has come to materialize long before. I remember putting out the special issue on the medical and the legal profession of the future in 1972.
Yeah, but the question was, is did you feel as though the change at the time
was
as fast as now? Like, do you feel that the world now is moving at a faster pace than it was, you know, when you were 50, let's say, or when you were...
No, I couldn't say that. No.
Okay.
I kept going with the... but not the acceleration that you have today with...
Right, so that's the point.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But still, it was moving quite fast. I mean,
right.
we have accomplished in 100 years what took thousands of years of civilization to get to the point where we are. It's a constant acceleration.
Yeah.
One thing that concerns me about this issue is that it seems to me that generally one talks about, you know, a rapid and increasingly accelerating pace of change.
Right.
We never seem to get to talk about the exercise by what I would call civil society of some kind of meaningful control over this. To talk, you know, the implication always seems to be that either it can't be controlled or it shouldn't be controlled. And I would like to suggest that maybe we ought to try to start to think about getting away from that and realizing that we can control it.
Right.
Anyway, I know it's controversial, but I just want to mention that.
No, that makes sense. Okay.
To get to the point with like this exponential growth.
Yep.
Gordon Moore, he points towards that when he was, we all know more or less what Moore's law is. When he was writing back in 62, he was saying the amount of computer power he could buy year on year increased by a factor of two for the same money. So that meant, you know, when he went to go buy a chip in 1962 for X amount of dollars, he would get Y amount of product, but in the year after that, you would get two times that for the same amount of X money. And then you keep on going. By the time it would have been 1972, for example, he would have paid X amount of money for 512 times the amount of computer power he would have been doing back then. Now, if we were to follow Moore's law until today, it's been revised to either 18 or 24 months for doubling time. They say, like, the amount of computing power compared to 1962 is 87 million times more than it used to be. But the thing is, it also starts gradual. So, like, imagine putting a penny into a bank account that, you know, works on doubling time. Next day, you have 2 cents, then 4 cents, then 8 cents. By the end of the month, you have $1 million. Like,
I see.
Very meaningful.
I see. So that's a great example of how the pace of technological change is always increasing. Great. So I wanted to I mentioned that, you know, given that pace of change, this idea that we can cram as much education in at the beginning of our lives is becoming a little bit called into question, right? Lifelong learning, how are we going to go about doing that? So what I wanted to sort of bring up is that the sort of traditional link between learning and earning has actually tended to follow quite a simple rule, right? The idea in the past has always been that the more formal education you can get early in life, the more benefits you will reap later in your career. So that's sort of represented by this, where sort of in a traditional fashion, you look, okay, well, as you go up the spectrum of education, you see unemployment rate decreasing, and typically you see salary increasing. So that's how we've traditionally thought about it. And that's sort of been kind of a driver behind wanting to pursue higher education. So, and a lot of people actually believe that technological change actually only strengthens the case for even more education. This is this idea of cognitive non-routine tasks being those that are sort of, I guess, sheltered from automation versus non-cognitive routine tasks that are at risk of automation. But in fact, the reality is actually more nuanced. So the returns on education, even for highly skilled, have become less clear. Between 1982 and 2001, the average wages earned by American workers with a bachelor's degree actually rose by 31%. So that's 82 to 2000. And those of high schoolers did not move at all. And this is according to the Federal Reserve. But in the following 12 years, so that's 2001 until about 2013, those wages of these college grads actually fell far more than their less educated peers, and tuitions, of course, continued to rise. So...
Sorry, Matthew.
Yeah?
How can the wages fall and have that connected with tuition?
There really isn't much to, there is no connection to tuition, right? I just mentioned that as just sort of like an aside, being like, okay, well, if wages are actually falling by the most educated, right, while tuition is rising, like there's not necessarily any correlation between the two. It's just something I thought I'd mention, because I mean, that's another stat that I don't have a chart for, but that I have seen, is that in that time period, you've seen the highly educated, there are those with those degrees, their wages are actually decreasing, you know, in inflation-adjusted terms, when tuitions are actually rising, yeah. Inflation-adjusted terms.
But that, I mean, part of the hole in that is 2008, 2009, down there in the States, 2010
right.
and 2011 as well.
Right. But the economy actually rebounded quite quickly 2009, 2010, 2011. If you actually look at stock market performance as well.
I would argue that it bounced back better here than it did in
right.
the States.
Right.
The difference is that they have continued to roar and we kind of flatlined.
Right. So, yeah, no, I mean, there's no doubt that there's, potential issues with the data. But if you actually look, I wish I had more recent data. That one was to 2013. This one's a little bit more recent. This is to 2015, where we're actually seeing that, you know, we can say that the decision to go to university still makes the most sense, right? But the idea that I'm just trying to sort of tease out is that the idea of a mechanistic relationship between education and wages is becoming a little bit problematic, right? So there's actually a recent survey by the Pew Research Center showing that a mere 16% of Americans think that a four-year degree, and this is recent, this is a 2017 study, this one, showed that a mere 16% of Americans think that a four-year degree course actually prepares students for a high-paying job in the modern economy. Why do you think that they would say something like that? What do you guys think? Yep.
Well, I've got a few thoughts on it. First of all, in the States, their education costs are far higher than ours.
Yep, that's absolutely
so
right.
So the first thing they go is, can I afford that amount of debt to get what you come out of the chute with?
Mm-hmm.
In Canada, we pay a lot less.
Right.
And we come out of the chute and we pay, somewhat less than, we're always a little less than the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in terms of
so your hypothesis would be that answer to that question would be very different if we asked Canadian students, either.
Yeah, because I mentor students at another local university,
right?
They're going through for the degree, and I'm involved in one program. It's called Backpack to Briefcase,
mm-hmm.
and the kids are trying to figure out, okay, do I stay in university, do I stay in the program I'm in, what do I need to do in order to graduate and get into the world where they can get earning something decent. So they're already retooling while they're in school.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm seeing that
right.
firsthand, but I think the U.S., I think part of the problem there is just the cost of their education. Does this job?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to have a couple more stats on the cost of education in the U.S. for sure. Yep.
Is it somehow linked to the content of education, of higher
perhaps.
Education, because of course you have this general and knowledge that is so important to build on these bases,
mm-hmm. a foundation.
Learning.
Yep.
But this foundation is not that rewarding, because when you finish a general MA, BA in something, sometimes you feel, I feel like that. I studied political sciences and I said, okay, who's going to pay me to write papers?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well,
it was like you had to sort of build upon that.
So,
right?
Yes,
yeah.
And I think maybe the sense that what is taught at the university is not connected.
Mm-hmm.
So reality,
so I'm gonna talk
image.
About that a little bit. Yep. Okay. Interesting. Yep.
I find, just from general knowledge, Americans tend to think a bit more conservatively than most people would.
Okay.
I guess conservative ideas to what students actually do in universities, they'd study things like, they'd study gender studies, or they would study
right.
international studies, such as myself, or poli-sci, and very conservative-minded people can't begin to understand where one, a student would want to do that, and where they would find a job in the future from that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to chat a little bit more about that coming forward as well. Yep.
I'm going to perhaps add on to the comment my colleague made in terms of universities as preparing generalists. Hence, many students opt out to, in order to find a job, is educating. The question comes to, is education for the sake of education, or is it to get you a job at the end of
mm-hmm.
3-4 years? And hence, many go to technical colleges and are
right.
more employed. I think with the generalists, one of my surprise coming to Canada after 15 years of absence, 4 years degree doesn't give the students that critical thinking capacity. I think a generalist degree is fine,
mm-hmm.
but if you're not prepared for a critical thinking of in the rapidly changing world, even a 6 years degree is not going to help you. Mm-hmm. As there is a disconnect between the job opportunities and the education.
Absolutely. Yep, one last one.
Just reflecting on some of the comments made here, I think back to when I was in first year university back decades ago. And I remember my first year sociology prof referring to our undergraduate degrees we were embarking on as giving us bragging rights to talk at a cocktail party.
Right, yeah. So I'm going to touch on this a little bit more, because what I'm not saying is that you shouldn't go and do a 4 year. That's not the point of what I'm saying, right? And you'll see that, in fact, it's actually extremely valuable, and I'm going to touch on that as we move forward. But what I'm just sort of trying to tease out, and also with this, you know, you see by income bracket, 15 to 24 years old, you see that their median household income has actually stayed flat, basically, all through since 65 to 2015, meaning that, you know, there's phases of growth that are really just not happening, which is sort of just to keep on the radar. You know, we're living in a different world, and you know, there may be an issue, or rather a flaw in this belief that having a lot of education at the beginning of your career is going to necessarily lead to higher wages in the future. So that's really the point here, which leads into...
Can you not leave that chart for half a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
So since you don't stay in that age group, like, say, take the bottom one, you don't stay in that age group forever. You grow older, and you will advance
of course.
Through to those other age groups, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, does
so but it's a measure each year of the people that are found in that age group, right?
Right. So that simply... I think what that says is young people are in real wages are making the same dollars now as they made back in the 60s.
That's right. Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that people will not advance through, because clearly the chart shows the older you get, the more you make.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But what it's saying is that throughout, you know, the idea is that with technological progress and more education, the idea is that real wages would be rising over time, right? But what this chart actually shows is that real wages aren't rising over time in each income bracket. That's what it shows.
Real wages being strip out inflation?
Strip out inflation, exactly.
Why would they change?
Well, the idea is that with technological change, more opportunities would arise, and therefore pay would go up, right? Unless you assume that someone of a certain age, and I'm going to talk about this when we move forward, should always be making the same, because they're sort of at the first rung in the ladder.
Right.
If that makes sense, right? That's
yeah,
that's an assumption that we may be making. Yeah, that's what you're seeing, exactly.
Just to go back to that question,
yeah.
Have you thought that maybe the young people look around and see that the people who are getting paid very highly don't necessarily need a degree, like the YouTubers and the gamers.
Yep.
And a lot of people who have maybe not finished their degrees, some of the role models even in entrepreneurship, and they feel that it's not a necessary step to achieve being rich or being singers.
Yeah.
And you have sports people, like so many people that are the highest paid jobs did not finish a degree.
Right. I think that it's sort of very, you know, often we find examples at the margin, right? What I'm sort of trying to do is generalize about, you know, what the largest majority of people are doing, but there's certainly great examples of people that, you know, at a young age have been able to do things outside of the traditional model. But we're sort of trying to focus on is, you know, how education is changing for the majority of people and what sort of ways we can reconceptualize lifelong learning, if that makes sense. So I just want to move on to something else here in terms of, we're going to put traditional education, the four-year degree, to the side for now, and we're going to come back to it, but I want to sort of look at what role employers are playing in this kind of new world, right? So when we talk about the role of employers in fostering continuous learning and education, what should their role be? Because we hear sort of in corporate circles and in the kind of you know, in the popular media, this adage that people are your most valuable asset, right? So everyone says it, but what does it really mean? What it typically means is really sort of recruitment, retention, and increasing of productivity within your organization. And the simple answer is that really it's happening. Businesses are really waking up to the fact that they have a role to play in employee learning and continuous learning. So I was actually, you know, looking into whether or not employers are actually waking up to this in terms of transitioning these kind of students out of four-year degrees into somebody who can sort of add value in a modern business, right? And there's a lot of different companies, like for example, Infosys, which is actually a business services firm, who actually on a quarterly basis runs his team through various problem-solving exercises, which actually focuses on action and planning rather than sort of routine tasks. The idea is to really build a deep understanding of customer needs. And they're really, what they're realizing is that, you know, and it's interesting you hinted at that in terms of learning how to learn, right? Businesses are actually learning or sort of realizing that the most valuable skills that they can have amongst their employees are foundational skills, so soft skills. And so I thought it'd be interesting to sort of put up here, the GMAT, I don't know if you guys are aware, is sort of a standardized test that people who want to go to business school need to write in order to apply to do an MBA. And these are sort of the skills that are most in demand right now for new graduates from business schools. And so it's interesting, you know, that managing administrative activities, managing human capital, managing strategy and innovation are actually more on the low end, whereas oral communication, listening skills, written communication, presentation skills are on the high end. So in fact, what's happening is that these are the types of skills that the labor market is really rewarding, even in this age of incredible digitization and, you know, proliferation of robotics, artificial intelligence, and things like that. So you're actually seeing more of a privileging of these types of soft skills rather than more sort of hard skills and vocational skills. Question? Yeah.
I just wanted to play the devil's advocate on that.
Okay, sure.
Because if you've got people who are strong on presentation skills, that might be because they come from a generation that's used to a lot of visual input, visual learning from computers and games. I would think that what you would need instead is more of the problem solving and the critical thinking.
Yeah. Well, I think that was certainly up there in terms of valuable skills. Let's see.
Seems to me that if people are making presentations, I'm talking generally now.
Right.
That they're talking to an audience.
Okay.
So you have one person who's doing most of the thinking and has done the thinking before they showed up for the presentation.
Okay.
And then the other people can, you know, buy into it or not. And
right.
Go for coffee. And get back to their desk.
Yeah.
How is that adding to productivity?
So, in terms of how is adding to productivity, I think what they sort of mean by presentation skills are really sort of the ability to relate to an audience, right? To relate to a customer, let's say, right? So things like empathy, things like you know, the ability to build relationships, right? I think that all kind of goes into the presentation skills. And I think that that's really what employers are kind of seeing in terms of, you know, who they're interested in hiring, right? So what I'm actually finding in terms of some of the research that I was doing is actually companies like Facebook, Google, are actively in their HR policies looking to hire what they've dubbed as learning animals. So these are actually people who have a growth mindset. So people that basically have demonstrated their ability to learn new things. And so this is sort of all playing into, as I mentioned before, the fostering of continuous lifelong learning. So businesses, what they're actually doing is they're not only recruiting for these types of talents, but they're actually going so far as to pay, so certain companies like Pratt and Whitney and also AT&T are actually giving their employees stipends of up to $12,000 US a year to actually take part-time courses in order to further their growth as learning animals, as I mentioned. All right, so a lot of the sort of old guard looks at this kind of fostering of employee learning as sort of a risk, right? Meaning that, well, if we're going to train up our employees, what if they leave? And that's like sort of a cost that we've lost, right? And the VP of HR at AT&T, actually, this is a direct quote from him, who actually stated that we would rather train the curious ones and have them leave than not train and have them stay, right? So it's this real kind of change in the corporate kind of mentality in terms of, you know, forward-thinking companies to sort of say, look, we realize that continuous learning is what is necessary to sort of create a culture and a business that's going to thrive in the innovation economy. And so how can we find people that have made lifelong learning their approach to doing business and their approach to life, right? So from all of this, really two questions arise.
May I ask you a question?
Yeah, absolutely.
What kind of learning? What kind of courses or whatever?
So in terms of what kind of learning, I mean, in the research that I was seeing, in particular AT&T, I mean, they actually have a program in place within their organization where they put each new employee on a learning path, right? So an example that I was reading about was that they, for example, have a receptionist who's hired, right? Who's working as a receptionist at one of the AT&T stores, let's say. And they actually sit down with HR, they're assigned a sort of mentor, and they actually have a discussion about where they would, the receptionist would like to see themselves go in the business, right? So maybe it's, in time, they're sort of more interested in product. So maybe one day they'd like to be a product manager. So what their HR manager actually does is sits down with them and helps them to sort of conceptualize a plan as to how and what specific education they will need and even what skills they will need to eventually get to that product management role that they'd like to get to, right? And so what's interesting about this is that you're seeing this transition occurring from, you know, where somebody starts in their education, you know, in a four-year university degree, making it into their first job, and then the business taking up this or picking up the slack in terms of helping that particular employee to grow as an individual, you know, both as a person but also as an employee in their career to get to wherever they want to go, right? Because they understand that the formal education system has sort of, I guess, failed or at least hasn't been able to aid someone to continue along that path as they grow in their career.
If they can go on learning, it's because at some point in their previous education, mm-hmm. in the basic education, they learned how to do it.
They learned how to learn. Yeah, so exactly. Absolutely. So that's a great point, and I'm going to touch on that a little bit more. But two sort of questions arise based on what I was discussing is, you know, can you screen potential employees on the basis of curiosity? Right? What do you guys think about that? Is it possible to hire for curiosity?
No.
No, you don't think so? You don't think it's possible?
I think large companies such as AT&T
yep.
and Google maybe can. But let's see what's the percentage of their market share in the labor market.
Mm-hmm.
The average is the small and medium-sized enterprises that create 60% of plus the jobs in the U.S. and Canada cannot afford. AT&T maybe can have specialists hire the curious and the intellectually curious. But for the SMEs, the answer is no.
So you think it's a luxury almost to be able to do that?
Absolutely, it's a luxury.
Hmm, interesting. Yeah.
So going back some time, but I don't think it's dated, and you kind of touched on it there. But there was a time when the large companies would inculcate the new hires with a great deal of education.
Right.
In my case, I was with IBM.
Right.
I had 1 year at the time in late 1970s. That was $100,000 worth of education they threw my way.
Wow.
They did that for every new hire.
Okay.
It did several things. It got you to the pinnacle of, you know, within a year of graduation, you're now at the pinnacle of being able to talk to all the technologies that you're now selling, for example.
Mm-hmm. And that lasted over the course of a year?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it was in and out between being in a field location and being in the classroom setting.
Hmm.
And even though I went into sales, I actually learned how to program the computers I was selling.
Yeah, I actually...
So I understood that stuff well.
Right.
So IBM wasn't the only one. If you went to any of the major consulting firms, and true on their accounting side,
right.
The idea was they would drive the education and they'd foster a spirit to be proud of.
Right.
And what would happen, even though you might lose them, if you did a good job of training them, in many cases, if the person was to leave, you might actually help place them in a company.
Wow.
As, you know, so it'd be a nice handoff to somewhere else. They'd remember that, and guess what? When someone said, who do you recommend? Well, I recommend the guys I just came from.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think you see sort of some remnants of that in the sense that, you know, as we've seen in some of the big companies, and I agree with this point, that a lot of the business activity is small and medium enterprise, but I think attitudes are changing. And so another sort of issue that arises here is, you know, can you train people to learn, right? And I think that's sort of what you were discussing where, you know, by putting programs in place as a corporation that sort of fosters this lifelong learning attitude, it could be possible to actually sort of empower and motivate people to continue that spirit of learning.
Yeah, the idea was you came out of university, didn't matter what you studied. The point is you can think at that level. Now we're going to train you specifically for what you need to equip yourself to make the next step.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So another thing that's interesting when it's when we're looking at sort of the role of employers in embracing learning as a core skill is really you're seeing the pay your dues model sort of eroding to a certain degree. And that was sort of touching on the chart that we saw originally where what businesses are finding, at least a lot of the ones that are successful, is that youth who are very steeped in innovation and digital technologies and whatnot are often extremely well placed to offer excellent ideas and solutions to business problems. And so what I was actually finding in some of the research that I was doing is that you're actually starting to see the average age of executives in North America decreasing, right? Because youth are getting more of a shot and there's a little bit more of a shift towards, I guess you could say, a meritocracy rather than a sort of a place where there's a lot of hierarchy, right, in the business world. And so, you know, basically where we're moving towards is more of a culture that's embracing merit in terms of employers rather than a culture that, and that sort of is tied up with this idea of learning, is fostering learning as a core skill, and then moving away from hierarchy, accepting new ideas and allowing the best ideas to rise to the top.
Can I throw something
at you? Yeah, sure.
I think, well, first of all, the demise of unions
right.
has gotten rid of a lot of seniority in a lot of companies mm-hmm. anyway. And 2008 certainly eradicated a lot of middle management. So when you talk about hierarchy, I mean, I left IBM, what was I? 1, 2, 3 steps away from the president.
Hmm. Wow.
Like,
interesting.
The company was that flat.
Right.
So you didn't have to go far through any bureaucracy or hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
There just wasn't one there.
Yeah.
And that's probably true of most companies.
I don't know about most companies, but it's definitely attitudes are starting to change because they're finding that, you know, that's just really what it takes to compete, right? The best idea is rising to the top. So we talked about the role of employers. And so I wanted to sort of touch on other sort of methods of fostering lifelong learning. And that's really through massive online courses, open online courses. So those are MOOCs, and then sort of alternative providers of education. So this is a sort of bootcamp coding model. Right. So in 2012, massive online courses were really sort of hailed as the beginning of the end for the four-year university degree. This new model of sort of open access university education was certainly, if we look at it, kind of something that is a welcome addition to the current system, but is really not really a full answer and certainly is not a substitute for four-year university education. Because really, I mean, dropout rates for these types of online courses are sky high, and the system is extremely fragmented. So you've got a lot of different players in the system where, you know, you have different sort of providers like the Khan Academy, you have Pluralsight, you have Coursera, you have EDX, you have Udacity. Has anyone heard of any of these massive online course providers? Yeah, you have? You have? Okay, cool. So has anyone taken any courses, any massive online courses? Yep. Yeah? And do you have a good experience doing that? Do you find it useful?
Well, yeah, certainly.
Okay, great. So it's interesting because this is kind of a fun model where, you know, what we're finding, and depending on what platform you actually look at, I've taken a few. I've taken some on Coursera. I've actually taken one on Udacity. What Udacity is unique for is really partnering with tech companies in order to create curriculum and content that is almost specifically tailored to the demands of that particular company. So in Udacity's case, they've actually teamed up with Amazon, IBM, Microsoft, Google to actually produce sort of micro nano degrees on machine learning, artificial intelligence, design, and also product management as well. A lot of data analytics and data science courses as well. And so it's kind of an interesting niche that some of the universities are not able to sort of fill, or at least not able to react fast enough to find that kind of demand in terms of that partnership between industry and education and these types of providers.
Excuse me, do you think that this MOOCs and so on, they are different because they partner with the private sector and so they're more relevant to the market?
Mm-hmm.
Or they are different because they have flexibility? Because I have a sense that, yes, in a sense, competition for university is there. Yeah, indeed. Mm-hmm. But I maybe, in a naive way, thought that maybe it was also because of the flexibility that it offers, whereas the university is a very, you know, presential teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be there every day of the week. Mm-hmm. So I thought that maybe this giving flexibility to university would offer us a possibility to keep the strong knowledge base that we have as universities, but still go towards other people.
Yeah.
That normally go towards MOOCs.
I think that's a really good point. It raises a few issues. So Coursera is actually the platform that has partnered with a lot of universities to offer content, right? So you have Wharton School of Business, you have Michigan University, you have USC. I mean, the list is endless of universities that are now sort of teaming up with Coursera and putting content online. The issue is that because a lot of these things are free, and these are the two sort of main issues that arise with massive online courses, and the first is really credentials, right? So how are you possibly able to, I guess, sort of validate whether or not the content of that particular course is valid and useful to a potential employer, because there's no way of sort of signaling, like a university can, right, the fact that they have, I guess you could say, established trust amongst the business world in terms of pointing to a history of, you know, graduates and you know, an ability to, you know, benchmark skills to a certain degree, right? Whereas massive online courses right now, because there's just so many different platforms, so many different course offerings, it's become very difficult, and that's sort of the main issue that's facing them is a quality standard, right? Another main issue that sort of faces massive online courses, and this is tied with their sort of compare and contrast with the university model, is that it's really about time, right? So balancing, and what's interesting, I'll mention this, I should have mentioned it earlier, with massive online courses, the majority of people who are taking them are already university educated, right? I think it's about 82% of people that take massive online courses already have a university education. And so, you know, we look at massive online courses as some kind of an answer to retraining people, but the fact of the matter is the majority of people who are taking these courses are already trained, right? They're already, you know, have some kind of an education, have some kind of a degree. And so, you know, going back to what I was saying about time, so balancing work life and ongoing sort of responsibilities is sort of very different. And so that's something that massive online courses can really address, is sort of making learning and delivery very flexible, right, in these sort of nano programs that can be done whenever you need to. Yep.
So this question was raised before, so what kind of learning?
Yep.
So as you say, these people are already educated, and this kind of courses, most probably the flexible and time, with the time constraint,
right,
they are somehow to the point. And maybe mostly to what, how we call it, this hard skills or technical skills, more
mm-hmm.
technical skills. But
exactly, because you're learning alone, right?
But yep. you very nicely put in the very beginning that the job style that is less susceptible to artificial intelligence is the cognitive
non-routine. Yep.
Non-routine.
Right.
So these non-routine education. For the non-routine cognitive jobs, this education will come from a general education.
Right.
And then these courses offer some very particular education.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And that's kind of what I was sort of going to be getting to in terms of these things all kind of fitting on top of each other, right? It's like Lego, right? You're building on top of one another, where it's not a substitute for university degree. So I was going to sort of get into this, but I'll get into it now. So massive online courses is one delivery method. Another are sort of boot camp coding camps. I mean, this is more of a tech focused thing, but I don't know if you guys are aware of a boot camp tech sort of coding camp called General Assembly, or maybe locally in Toronto, Brain Station. Have you heard of these? Yeah? Okay, cool. So I actually did some consulting work with Brain Station, and what we found was that on sort of sales meetings, right, when a potential student would come in and be sort of considering taking a course, you know, the comment was, for some of them, there was a couple of younger ones coming in saying, oh, well, maybe I'll just go into a four-year computer science degree, or should I come to you? And the answer was often, well, we don't actually compete as a coding boot camp with four-year university degrees. If you have the time and the money to do a four-year degree, then definitely go and do one, right? There are two different things, right? And most of the time, most of our students that were coming in were already, you know, had already done a computer science degree, and in the case of coding, some of them had, and almost all of them had already done some kind of a university degree. They were interested in building on their skills and taking a part-time course to actually add other skills to their toolbox of skills, right? Yep.
Sir, I'd make the observation, I'm a tech CEO in the city, so we hire almost half of our staff is under 30, don't really care what their degree is at all. I care if they're curious. I care that they are motivated. And there's a reason why is that, first of all, the shelf life of knowledge is so short. I think it's probably 12 to 18 months, maybe less. So what they learned, or what they came from, or their last job, is, I couldn't care less, completely irrelevant to me. Their ability to learn, incredibly valuable. Their curiosity, incredibly valuable, because that will help them learn. We co-fund 100% of our employees' continuing education for that reason. But what we see on top of that is that there's a huge demographic shift happening where workers are leaving the workforce in droves. It's the boomers are retiring. And so any smart, savvy tech company who wants to make sure that they have bodies in chairs doing work have to be very accommodating to the next cohort, the next generation of workers, because there's going to be a huge shortage of them. And so you have to be that kind of exceptional employer who goes the extra mile for their people in order to secure your labor force in 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. And so we pander to those people.
And I'm really glad you mentioned that, because this is a perfect example of the modern small to medium-sized business, right? People's attitudes are changing, because those medium to small-sized businesses that are going to do well are those that understand this exact thing that was just explained there, right? Yep.
I'm wrestling with three charts there. The last one on Coursera,
okay.
For example, the MOOCs, okay?
Okay.
That is non-traditional, highly cognitive kinds of stuff, right?
I wouldn't say...
High education, the material being delivered.
So I think the subject areas, I wish they're a little bit blurry there, but yeah, so the blue there is computer science and programming, so it's a big part of it. The yellow is business, the green is science,
right.
So it's a real mix.
So but it's a bunch of stuff, a bunch of learning,
right.
Which you can't automate, right?
Okay.
So we're in that top curve.
Yep.
The courses are free,
mm-hmm.
Delivered by very highly educated people. I'm trying to square that triangle as a...
So I'm not sure what you mean in terms of square the triangle, but...
Zero income to the people delivering those courses.
Well, no, it's not a matter of zero income. In fact, and maybe I should have mentioned this, so on Coursera, a lot of courses are free, but to get a certificate, right, that you can actually sort of print out and put in on your resume, you actually have to pay a small fee to get your work assessed, right? So a lot of courses, it's called a capstone project. They essentially, I've taken four of these courses, so I'm somewhat knowledgeable in the way it works. So a lot of people just take them for free, but that's why dropout rates are so high. Dropout rates become very low when people are actually paying for that credentialing at the end, which I think it's about $300, $350 typically, depending on the university that's partnered with them on the course. So I did one from Wharton, I did one from Michigan University, and then I can't remember the other one, I think it was from Harvard actually. So that way you actually can just have a little sort of certificate and paper and you pay that $350. So it's not no revenue in terms of the model. So one thing I want to talk about as well is really sort of, there's kind of a transition period. And so this was really great that we had sort of a tech CEO mention that, you know, he doesn't necessarily care what the university degree is because knowledge has such a short shelf life. We need more CEOs that think that way because it's really not the case that a lot of companies are thinking that way. In fact, if you actually look at what's really going on is that a lot of people find themselves almost in like a vicious cycle where they graduate a business degree or something, and that first rung in the ladder, that junior sales position, this junior marketing position, will typically require some kind of relevant work experience in order to get hired in that role, right? So in fact, this chart is kind of interesting where expectations, you know, a lot of grads expected most of them to be making 50 to 70,000 in their first job, as you can see by the red there, whereas the majority of them actually ended up making under 25,000 a year, right? So expectations matching with reality. We're still sort of in this zone where it's really hard to find pathways that lead to good paying work for the recent university grad. So we do look at as a model sort of vocational education, which is sort of blending classroom and work experience. So there's a real like opportunity there in terms of, you know, what's going on as a model. We can look at like lawyers, for example, or doctors that when they're in school, they're doing some training at the same time. And I think that there needs to be a little bit more emphasis put on that critical period, making that transition from your university degree into your first job. So there's actually different models that are being created. So there's actually an interesting model, LearnUp, which is a startup in the United States, which is actually just focusing on grads and helping them to get them into their first entry-level job. So in their business model, they're actually funded by employers in the United States. And what they allow college grads to do is to pick their first job, and they have sort of nano training sessions that they offer these students in order to prepare for their first job, whether it's, you know, as a salesperson or as a marketing, a junior marketing professional as well. So this is something that really needs a little bit more help, but as I mentioned, LearnUp Generation is another one that is actually addressing that in terms of doing that early kind of training to make that leap from the first university to the generalist degree into that first well-paying job. The question is that, is this the responsibility of universities? Could universities be doing more to bridge that gap? Yeah. So I just want to end, actually, sum up this sort of piece on education, looking at this sort of system as a whole, right? So we have a nascent system of lifelong learning that's starting to emerge. So we looked at how universities are changing, massive online courses, alternative web coding schools. We also looked at you know, the roles of employers, how employer attitudes are changing. And so, you know, what we're finding though is that, as I mentioned earlier, roughly 80% of Coursera's learners already have university degrees, suggesting that it's really not these types of learners that need a boost. So the costs of reskilling in terms of time, money, are really the easiest to bear for people that have savings, that can control their working hours, or work for companies that are really committed to upgrading their skills. So, you know, some people are just not interested in retraining. And a lot of these platforms that we discussed, these modern things, are actually just miles away for a lot of people, given sort of computer problem-solving literacy rates. So in Canada here, if you actually see the adult problem-solving skills using a computer, it's kind of interesting, where Canada, as you actually see that a little bit over 60% have none to low adult problem-solving skills using a computer. All right, so it's a little bit problematic. So, I mean, there's not really a clear path for this type of a worker to become a coder, let's say, or, you know, any other of these sort of modern professions. So numeracy and literacy skills, really, they need practice, right? And so any effort to kind of combat this problem is really going to need coordination between government, employers, education providers, individuals, and unions, in fact, right? So where we kind of see possibility is that, you know, trade unions can be there to kind of step in and help workers understand where the industry is moving and help people transition to the new skills that are going to be required. And then also government. So lifelong learning can really be fostered better by governments to sort of help, you know, schools and boot camps by funding them, but also, you know, they can do much more. So I want to mention just one example before we go on break. So Singapore, actually, which is quite a revolutionary city-state, they've put a program in place called Skills Future. And this basically makes it mandatory for all employers within Singapore to basically spell out all the changes, industry by industry, that they expect to happen over the next 3 to 5 years and identify the skills that they will need. The answers are used to create industry transformation maps that are really designed to help individuals on where to head. And then in this program, the Singaporean government actually is giving all citizens over the age of 25 around $345 to spend on about 500 pre-approved training courses that fit that industry map that all of the employers have put together, right? So this is quite an interesting program. And it's sort of really a nice example of how government is stepping in to foster people on that path of learning. So in conclusion, I just sort of, you know, want to mention that, you know, this continuous learning ecosystem is very exciting, but it's very much likely to benefit those that actually least need help. It's mostly focused on advanced technological skills, and, you know, these skills are the ones that are easiest to measure. It also assumes that people have the money and time and the motivation and the basic skills to be able to retrain. So if new models like Singapore with government support do not emerge, this new ecosystem that I've sort of described here really actually risks exacerbating inequality rather than improving it. So that's it for this one. And so we're going to move next, after a short break here, to just sort of looking a little bit closely at some economic and social aspects of emerging technologies. We're going to look at driverless cars, and then we're going to look at some sort of larger trends that are affecting companies and countries as well. So we'll go on a break, maybe 5-10 minutes, and we'll be back. Thanks.